through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hour number two of Tom, Jake, and Stacy. We're going to get into an ongoing storyline, something that's being, I'm going to use the term milked, because it now the national media has caught it, and I'm starting to get a little concerned that it's going to become an ongoing storyline throughout the season here. But before we get to that, there's been a retirement in the NFC West that should help the Seattle Seahawks. Jake, you want to service this one?
Yeah. Some interesting headline news. Starting safety for the Rams, Eric Weddle, ended up deciding to retire this year after signing a 2 or 3 year deal with the Rams this last offseason, and played a full year for them, and still very good player, very high level player for them, and really under Wade Phillips' defense allowed them to do a lot of different dynamic things, which made their coverage really hard to decipher. And so losing a guy like that who can freelance, who could do a bunch of different things, who was essentially the captain of their defense, putting them all in the right situations in the secondary, this is it's a big loss for them. Big loss for them, and we already talked about the Rams in terms of where they are at currently, in terms of cap space, draft capital. They are in bad straits, and losing a player like Eric Weddle, I mean, that's another big blow to them as they're moving into 2020.
You know, we talked a minute ago about the 49ers and whether or not they'll be able to survive the Super Bowl hangover because of all these different, you know, factors and elements. The Rams didn't make the playoffs, but to our knowledge, that didn't come about because of, like, infighting, did it? It had to do with Todd Gurley and injuries and things like that, right?
Well, their offensive line.
Yeah, their offensive line not being as great. Yeah, I guess the only controversy you could say was the mismanagement of Todd Gurley, right? It was still a mystery as to what they were doing. Sean McVay is, you know, saying, oh, he's just a part of rotation. There's not a plan in terms of trying to keep him healthy and all that. And so then it lends the question as to, okay, so is Todd Gurley is he not healthy or is he not good anymore? Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that was probably the biggest controversy that they were facing all season long. But yeah, I mean, and then they go and sign Jalen Ramsey, which to me is I wouldn't say desperate move, but it is we're trying to win now at all costs. And if you don't get it done, your franchise has been put back a number of years.
Yep. No doubt about it. All right. Moving on here to Russell Wilson. Now, about a week ago, was it more? I can't even keep track of this and his stuff anymore. It was Russell at the Pro Bowl. That's what it was. He spoke openly about his desire for more weapons, more playmakers. And we had, you know, a little mini controversy about that for a couple of days. But then yesterday I was reading Pro Football Talk, and they had an interview with him at the Super Bowl. This is Mike Florio and Chris Sims. And Russell was talking about his desire for something else. Why can't their offense get started earlier?
I think that's what we got to figure out, you know, as we're going throughout this offseason, and we're trying to capture that earlier on. Because I think we do it really well. I mean, we've always been really good at 2 minute
Amazing.
Offense. We've always been really good in those end of the half, those not always hurry up situations, but those up tempo moments.
Yeah.
And the reality is this: I think the defense gets tired. First thing.
Sure.
And right. The second thing is that, you know. You know, I really know kind of what I want to, you know, get after them and how we want to get after them, especially in those moments. And guys just make plays in those moments. I think the freedom of just going after and just scoring as many points, you know, that's kind of what the Chiefs do.
And that's what we're going to get into next. That's kind of what the Chiefs do, is his envy of the Chiefs. There's another soundbite. But doesn't every offensive player or every quarterback kind of feel that way? Like, I just want to go out there and I want to throw the ball around. I want to play my backyard ball and just do whatever I want.
Yeah, there is a lot of elements to that. I mean, you're looking at when you go into those up-tempo situations, you're in 2 minute, you're playing with more aggression, you're putting more pressure on the defense in terms of the approach that you have. And then, you know, in Russell's career, just traditionally, it started with Daryl Bevel, and it's continued that in 2 minute, the quarterback calls the plays. And so, you know, I think that it's something when he says, you know, I feel like I have great command of the situation. you know, that's something that traditionally he's done a very good job running the operation and you know, getting them into the right situations and all that. So that part of it, I think, is fun as a quarterback to have that level of control at times. And so you look at it, and I don't feel this as I want to throw the ball all over the yard. I feel this as a style of play. I want our offense to be more of the aggressor. I want to play with great tempo. I want to be at the line of scrimmage, or you know, even from the tempo of when you get the play call to calling the play to the line, just playing with that. To the line, playing with such a great tempo that it's constantly putting the defense on their heels, like the Rams play, for example, like they've done to the Seahawks on multiple occasions. So I think it's just trying to describe, you know, it's more about trying to play with tempo and try and be the aggressor to the defense instead of trying to sit back, you know, slow down clock, slow down the game, and really, you know, try and win the game in the fourth quarter, that type of concept.
I understand where he's coming from on this completely, but this is another example of Russell now speaking out publicly about his desires as far as what he wants to see them do. It's like another little breadcrumb for people like us to chew on. But do you see this as Russell working through the media trying to get a message to Pete and Shoddy? Or do you see it more as he's already, you know, on the same page with Pete and Shoddy, and he's just delivering the message to the public because he's being asked?
Maybe a little bit of both, but primarily the latter. I'm sure he's communicated this to Pete Carroll and John Schneider for that reason, much less Brian Schottenheimer. I think that they have a very unique relationship, a relationship that you would see with a franchise quarterback who's been in the league for a while, who's respected, who has, I think, good, what's the way to say this? A kind of capital and power.
Equity?
With his equity, a good equity with his own team, in that they recognize that he's an indispensable part of their team. Not only have they showed that with what they've invested in him, but I think with Pete Carroll's culture in particular, he's someone who I think has always valued players advocating for themselves, players becoming part of a not like any kind of management level, but he's always valued the idea of asking veteran players for help leading younger players, of asking veteran players for input and advice. And I think that it's a unique kind of value that player coaches have. And I think that as you get older in his system, a way to make it less repetitive is to take on some ownership of your team.
And certainly the quarterback, I mean, we've said a million times, the quarterback is in essence an extension of management.
Yeah, it's kind of like middle management.
Right. And so of all players to advocate for themselves, the quarterback should certainly be the one to do that. I want to give you one more soundbite here. This is where Russell goes on. He sounds to me envious of the Chiefs.
They do a really good job. Andy Reid and Mahomes, they do a really good job of getting up to the ball, playing with their playmakers, and finding a way to make plays. And, you know, they score more points than everybody else. And I think that's the name of the game, is can you score one more point than they do?
Right.
And there's different ways to go about it. Listen, the reality is we've won a lot of football games
you
over
have.
The years.
I know. We hold you to a very high standard.
But we also, I think there's also the expectation of being here, not just sitting here in this seat next to you guys, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. Being on the big banner
but being on the big banner and winning it all. So,
yeah.
You know, we're gonna try to figure that out and see if we can get back here quickly.
I mean, is he saying that the reason why he's sitting in that seat and that he's not on the field is because his offense doesn't play like the Chiefs?
No, I don't think that that's it. I think as you're reflecting on the year, there's always ways that you can get better as a group, and you can always continue to evolve and progress. And I think that you look at 2018 to 2019, there was evolution and growth there, not at the level that maybe everybody else would love to see in terms of Russell Wilson throwing early on early downs and having more attempts and all that, but they did more than what they did the year previous. So I think this is, you're looking at a player that the reality is the Pete Carroll, Brian Schottenheimer, John Schneider, Russell Wilson, they're in communication. I mean, if you don't think they're in communication about, you know, thought processes for how they can get better in 2020, then you're thinking wrong. They're in communication. I think when you look at Russell Wilson talking here, is there just a lot of obvious things that he's saying, though? Like, It is one thing for him to say, to not say, oh, I think we've got a great thing going on. I think, you know, we're right where we want to be and we can move forward. That would be like the PC easy answer. But there's also some reality to saying, look, the Chiefs are doing some great things. They're playing with a more up-tempo style. I like playing in that style. And I think we can continue to keep getting better because I want to get it to the Super Bowl. I don't want to be sitting here talking to you, Chris Sims. I want to be playing in this Super Bowl coming up. And I think that there's some ways that we can get it done. So I don't mind this really in the sense that as long as those four guys that I just mentioned are on the same page, then it doesn't really matter to me, and I believe that they are. I don't think this is Russell saying something that they haven't heard before.
It is significant that for the first time in 9 years, Russell is coming out and saying things like, hey, we need more weapons, more playmakers, and, you know, why can't we get started earlier? It's significant, but I don't want anybody in our audience to think that because we're talking about it, it's necessarily a bad thing. I'm not trying to make a controversy out of it. I'm not saying that Russell is working through the media trying to send a message to his head coach.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think if I'm John Schneider and Pete Carroll, if I'm going into the offseason, into free agency, and into the draft, what do I want to get? Playmakers!
Right.
Superstars.
Yes, superstars. Right. I want to get the very things that Russell is talking about there. So I don't think that there's a controversy necessarily, but this is another small evolution, I think, of Russell Wilson coming out and as the leader of the team and saying, look, last year wasn't good enough. Here's where we want to go. Here's how I expect us to get there.
He's being more candid in his answer, right?
Yeah.
And isn't that what everybody's wanted him
He's
to do?
He's just talking football.
Right.
I mean, some guys,
he is.
Look, there's a danger for football players to be too candid with the media if they're just sitting there talking ball. But that's all it is.
Correct.
Like if you were to run into Russell Wilson at the grocery store and you'd be like, hey Russ, what's going on, man? You know, what have you been up to this offseason? What are you guys thinking? Oh, we're just trying to get better, just trying to, you know, we're looking for some superstar players, draft, free agency, whatever. It's that casual.
Yes.
He's just talking ball. It's nothing more than that.
Right. And the way that I hear him talking right now in those sound bites that you just played, that to me sounds very much like him and just, you know, openly talking. And I think that part of it is, as you're moving forward, again, your franchise quarterback, your offensive coordinator, your head coach, hopefully you're continuing to try and find ways to progress and reflect and say, how can we get better? What can we do things realistically that can change? He's not saying we need to throw the ball like the Kansas City Chiefs. Hey, maybe our tempo can be different. Maybe that type of aspect can be different for us moving forward.
Right now, we're in four down territory.
This is four down territory.
With Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
What are the immediate ways that the Seahawks defense can become more aggressive?
Immediate ways they can become more aggressive. One, it's personnel, right? Getting these superstar talented type of players so that they can play the exact style of what Pete Carroll would like to do, particularly in the pass rush. But from a schematic standpoint, it's getting back to nickel. It's getting back to the idea of you're playing more match cover three and man-to-man principles than trying to play, you know, too high, cover two, cover four type of shells. But get back to that cover one, cover three, hard nose, we're going to be in the box, stop the run game, hit you if you come over the middle type of attitude. And I think that part of it would be key for this group moving forward. And it's trusting in your young players, trusting in those guys to step up and make plays for you instead of looking at this like a Marquise player that we talked about yesterday and saying he's too much of a liability. His playmaking ability does not outweigh the liability factor. As a coach, you always have to go back and forth on that. But what we saw out on the field was Marquise Blair could go out there and play with speed and play with impact, make big plays, and you've got to trust those guys to go and do that and empower them to do that. I think that those are some very easy ways for those guys to get aggressive in one offseason.
Second down. Stacey, what other contending teams are the Seahawks going to compete with in free agency?
So, Clowney has already said he wants to go to a contender. So that's the number one prerequisite for where he goes. It's not just a team that has money. Miami has the most cap space of any team this offseason. Clowney's already turned them down once, refused to trade there, instead opting to be traded to Seattle, kind of demanding the terms of his own trade there. So Miami, I think, is out of the picture this time around, despite the fact that they have the most cap space. So I took a look at a couple teams with that have a bit of wiggle room. So Seattle's kind of seventh overall, near the top of the pack with $60 million, but also in there is Buffalo, a playoff team with $81 million. Dallas in there with $73 million. They already have DeMarcus Lawrence playing their 4-3 defense, which Clowney played in this year. Obviously, all of these teams, and I'll preface it by saying this, have their own moves to make this offseason. This cap space isn't staying the same, but feasibly, they could make this signing. You've also got New England in there, $44 million. Bill Belichick, a contender every year, probably going to be a Super Bowl favorite this year, was the number one defense ahead of the 49ers in the regular season. But then some wild cards I'm throwing in here. You've got Tennessee with $48 million in cap space. Now, it is near South Carolina, Clowney's home. You have a former linebacker coach in Mike Vrabel, who will effectively be his own defensive coordinator, kind of like Bill Belichick. You've got another playoff team that's a contender. My other wild card that I like, which Kyle disagrees with me on, Arizona. Arizona Cardinals did not make the playoffs, did not have a great record, but I think they have promising pieces, A. B, they have $51 million in cap space. C, they have Chandler Jones. And if Clowney preferred that kind of 3-4 defense, they returned to that in 2019 under defensive coordinator Vance Joseph. So I think that's certainly one that could be in there. Another playoff team with cap space is Philadelphia with $42 million. But I don't know if Clowney's going to Philadelphia. I don't know how that's going to work out. That relationship between that team and that player would certainly be an interesting one. Obviously, there are other teams like San Francisco and Kansas City, but they don't have nearly as much cap space. They have their own signings to make. So while it's possible, and they're two Super Bowl teams, I would be a little more surprised to see him land there. Wouldn't rule it out, but they have their own cap decisions to make.
How much less money would you be willing to take to go to a team that you know is at least guaranteed to go to the playoffs, barring some major injury?
Well, that's the thing. And it's not like Arizona's near the top. Seattle actually has $10 million more in cap room than Arizona. But one of the things we were talking about is, well, what if Clowney wants to go to a place where he knows it's not all going to be on him? And Jake said something interesting, which is like, well, one of the first things the Seahawks are going to have to do is prove that they can help him out and maybe make an early signing and show him we have someone worth coming here for. So they already have Chandler Jones in Arizona. It could be just enough to convince Clowney, hey, I'm not going to be the one being double teamed on every single play.
By the way, you mentioned Tennessee being close to South Carolina.
Closer than Seattle.
Definitely. But it's funny, like you look at Tennessee on a map, because it's such a long state, I bet you it takes 8 hours to drive across that thing. I can't tell how close, like, Nashville is to wherever
he's
from.
Oh, if I'm being paid $22 million a year, you can bet I have a private jet. That's how I'm getting to South Carolina from Tennessee.
Do they all have private jets?
Why not, Tom?
Well, I wouldn't say not? They all do. But if you're getting paid that high,
$22 million,
it's probably, you know.
Well, no, it would be like
now,
4 years.
Their own private jet,
you know, $100 million or something.
Look,
like that.
Look, they don't all have their own private jet, but there are private jet services
available
that you can charter private jets.
You can share a private jet. It's the economy approach,
you know, like,
to private.
Yeah,
jet.
like Russell Wilson, he's with Wheels Up. You know, that's one of his companies that he invests in.
I don't want to share. I want my own plane.
Well, you still can get your own plane.
Maybe,
but you're just chartering your own plane.
Yeah.
That's how you're going about it. It's the rich life that we know nothing about. None of us know anything about this.
Speak for yourself, Jake.
Oh,
that's
sorry.
That's how I got to work today.
Oh, you did?
Private
right there
jet.
from Green Lake?
Yes. It was a very short flight.
A shuttle from Tennessee to South Carolina. Next. Sorry, I mean third down.
Third down.
I goofed. How do you think the Seahawks need to go about surrounding Russell Wilson with more talent amongst the skill positions?
It's really going to be one of those conversations that as you talk about this, okay, let's surround Russell with more talent, all right? How do you go about that? Is it going about it by getting a veteran player like Greg Olsen, who's 35, but you know that when on the field he is a great, great contributor in this league, that he is a top 10, maybe even top 5 tight end in the league? Maybe that is the answer, or maybe it's getting younger and going through the draft and looking at it saying, look, we got Russell Wilson, a legitimate talent in DK Metcalf. Was he raw? Was he rough around the edges? Yes, he was, but he had the speed, the size, the talent, and what was he able to do? He was able to take him under his wing, mentor him, and DK Metcalf was willing to put in the work that Russell Wilson wanted him to, and look at the connection that they were able to have in 1 year as a rookie for DK. That's something I think you have to consider if you're the Seahawks in terms of where you want to spend your capital. Maybe it's going out and getting a AJ Green type of player, Randall Cobb, somebody like that, where you can feel good about receiver number three and then go young in the tight end room. So there's a lot of different ways that you can go about this, but you have to get frontline talent, and evaluating where you can get that. It's a very rich receiver draft this year. So maybe they draft another receiver highly and they get a veteran tight end. But I think it's the ebb and the flow of this. Is I don't think you can go out and spend both in free agency. It's going to be one or the other.
Fourth down. Do you think the Seahawks would be willing to take Michael Bennett back in Seattle? I shouldn't phrase it that way. Would they be willing to take him back?
Would they be interested in him?
Yeah, would they be interested in him? Yeah.
Would they take him back?
Please take me back! That's not a good way to put it.
Look, Michael Bennett, still at his age, can absolutely contribute to an NFL team. The biggest thing for me in terms of Michael Bennett at this point in time is he going to fall in line? Is he going to... Is the drama going to escape? Is he not going to be, you know, a guy that is disruptive in team meetings? You know, and again, when I say that, it's not from the standpoint that he is just completely, degenerate and making life hard. It's from the standpoint of I'm going to do things my own way because I've done them my whole career instead of listening to the coaching and being acceptable to that. Or receptive to that and being a good influence on the young players. I think that's really where the question is. If he's willing to do that, I think the Seahawks absolutely think about bringing him back because of the experience that they had with Marshawn Lynch. Marshawn Lynch had a whole lot laundry list of issues with the Seattle Seahawks before that. He comes back, he plays a tremendous mentorship role. There was nothing but positive things from that experience. So maybe that one lends to them possibly bringing him back. I would think it's a long shot, but through that experience, maybe it's a conversation.
Halftime show is up ahead. What's going to happen if the Seahawks don't re-sign Jadeveon Clowney? We'll talk about it on Tom, Jake, and Stacey, 710 ESPN Seattle.
It's time for the halftime show.
The half is not over. There's 3 seconds on the clock.
Revisiting the biggest stories of today at the midpoint of the show.
The halftime show, it's not easy.
Now, here's Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
What's going to happen if the Seahawks don't sign Clowney? What's going to happen? What are they going to do?
The panic? World will explode.
Panic time?
Yeah. There'll be a little bit of panic, I think. But... I think there'll be a little bit of panic. Who are you going to replace that with? I mean, you got a real chance of getting a frontline guy like Clowney. And what are you going to do from that point on? Are you going to go out and try and pay Chris Jones, Yannick Ngakoue? Are you going to go after the big money? Or are you just going to try and hit in the, you know, $8 to $12 million type of guys on defensive pass rush and see if you can make those guys work? And again, I say that as like you're. You know, you're taking a risk there. You're getting good quality players, but they're not guys that are traditionally churning out sacks after sacks every year. You're getting guys that are more like, you know, 8 sack guys, which at this point I would gladly take. That's more than double than what we had from our leading sack getter last year.
Oh, you're good.
I was just confirming.
Oh.
That is indeed a fact.
I want to go back to something that we were arguing about earlier in the show. We were talking about Clowney as a run stopper and him... or the team being ranked 22nd in the league as far as stopping the run. I thought you were saying that he was really the only one with any run-stopping ability, but we kind of ran out of time there. What about guys like Bobby and KJ? They didn't contribute to that at all either?
Well, they didn't make a lot of plays at the line of scrimmage. I mean, that's the thing is we talk about Bobby and we talk about KJ, and they had good years for themselves. And statistically, it shows. But when we're sitting in here and we're like, where is that big play ability? Where is that big game-changing play from Bobby Wagner? that to your eyes, I mean, it's very real. It just, there wasn't a whole lot of tackles that were happening at the line of scrimmage or behind the line of scrimmage. You got it every now and then, but it just wasn't on a consistent basis.
So where were they? Sideline to sideline, that type of thing?
Well, sideline to sideline, or it was, hey, it was a 3-yard gain instead of, you know, being at the line of scrimmage. So it's not all on the linebackers. I mean, your linebackers, just like your quarterback in some aspects, your play is predicated off the guys in front of you. And if your guys aren't, if your defensive linemen are doing a great job holding their gaps and their responsibilities, then the offensive line is able to get up to the second level and get their hands on Bobby and KJ, and those are things that limit you from making those types of plays. So overall, this defensive line as a whole, you know, stopping the run in that front just wasn't as good as what you would expect it to be on paper, because you had Clowney, you had Reed, you had Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, and towards the back half of the season, they really, really struggled.
It's just so confusing, because at what point, especially for a D lineman, think about it. We always talk about it as the line, whether it's D line or offensive line. At what point is football, or at what point should we evaluate guys as an individual? Mm-hmm. At what point should we evaluate them as a line working together? I mean, is the reason why Clowney's stats were down because nobody else around him was making plays and he was just going all out trying to do too much?
Well, I think that's
Or Wagner and KJ and Reed, I won't say were they playing well, but were they playing at least okay, average? And was it Clowney that was disappointing?
Well, I think that's why players can sometimes get frustrated, because football is such a team sport. Not even in the sense of you have to play together, but you might be covering someone else's assignment or their area.
Right.
And we talked about this with corners. Like, if you're the guy to make a tackle, it might have been someone else's fault, but immediately you're going to get flagged for it, and someone's going to say, oh, that's on him. You know, that's on Ward for missing that instead of whoever else was responsible for it in the Super Bowl.
Brady Henderson on with Danny and Gallant this morning, saying that Clowney may test the market.
He's going to get the free agency, and as we all know, when guys get there, the price has the potential to skyrocket when every team can bid on him. And, you know, I think even though he's coming off a season where he only had 2 sacks, he's still got a ton of pressure. He's still a marquee name. And I think that, you know, if he commands, you know, something in the neighborhood of what Khalil Mack got a couple of years ago, then if you're the Seahawks, you have to say, okay, yeah, we need this guy, but we also need more, because you saw that their pass rush was pretty ineffective with him. And so if it's just him, that's not going to be enough. And if he, you know, gets that top of the market deal, are you going to have enough to get somebody else?
Could Khalil Mack do it all on his own?
Can Khalil Mack? No.
Don't you feel like when he went to the Bears, that's kind of what happened?
Well, he's a tremendous player, but the Chicago Bears defensive front, they already had some dudes in the interior. So, you know, I mean, he was getting the opportunity. He was getting double teamed, and he had the ability to split them just like Clowney did at times. But also, he had those one-on-one opportunities more than Clowney did, because you had a better defensive front as a whole. So that's the part that I think for Clowney, he really has to take into consideration, not just the Super Bowl team, but how successful can he be if he's literally the only star talent that is on that defensive line, and he experienced it with Seattle. He's got to have more around him. And if you're going to go to Super Bowl, you got to have that anyway. So I think the line is very much the same if you're John Schneider and the Seahawks, you know, organization, as to how they're trying to solve it. So I think it goes more hand in hand than anything else. But what Brady said, it does have a tendency to skyrocket. Frank Clark's contract skyrocketed from what the Seahawks originally thought that they could get for him. So, I mean, it is a possibility. It's a legit possibility that Clowney doesn't sign back, but I think the Seahawks are willing to pay a pretty high mark for him.
Next. This goes back to me and my ESPN watching last night while it was dark and pouring rain and I didn't feel like going outside at all. When I see anything having to do with the NBA, because the trade deadline is today, I feel so disconnected.
Me too.
From that world of sports, because we don't have a team here. And there's obvious resentment that still lingers between people here in Seattle and the NBA itself, just as a sport, right? Not just the Oklahoma City Thunder. It's not just that. So when I'm on Twitter here, I don't know how many people from the NBA that you guys follow on Twitter, but when I see news breaking left and right about this trade or that trade, I'm just kind of looking at it going, yeah, huh? Yeah, huh? Yeah, huh? All right, Andre Drummond, good for you, buddy. You know, you want to rip the Pistons on the way out the door, fine.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're still interested in big news stories and, you know, like many other people who aren't regular season watchers of the NBA, they still turn in to see, you know, Zion Williamson's debut or whatever. But it's hard to get as invested in trades and day-to-day moves when you don't have a team.
It is hard. The only one that I was interested was Andrew Wiggins and the D'Angelo Russell trade, that he's going to the Golden State Warriors. And the only reason why is because Wiggins went to Kansas. So,
do you know
rock chalk. No,
he would have been there right after you, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly when that aligned happened. If that happened right after I transferred to Miami,
I think he got there in 2013, Andrew Wiggins.
Yeah, so I would have been there. Yeah. That would have been, I was there. I was there that year.
You guys just weren't friends.
Yes, we just weren't friends.
Got
we
it.
Passed each other, you know, in the...
ships passing in the night.
In the athletic, in the academic center, you know. But no, we didn't communicate.
I see this tweet from Andre Drummond. If there's one thing I learned about the NBA, there's no friends or loyalty. I've given my heart and soul to the Pistons, and to have this... And to have this happen with no heads up makes me realize even more that this is just a business. I love you, Detroit.
It's interesting, because usually when you see these trades over the last couple years, it has been more player determined, you know?
A lot of power. Well, top tier players.
Yes, and they're saying, hey, this is where I want to go. But imagine that you don't even know what's going on. Just like Quandre Diggs last year. He was sleeping on the couch.
You're a defensive captain.
He's taking a
also.
Nap. Right, and he gets a call waking him up from his nap, and that's how he finds out that not only are they thinking about it, but, no, you've been traded.
It's such a great point. And Scott Van Pelt, actually, on his show last night, I thought the way he put it was great. Like, for the rest of us, we know where we're going to go to work tomorrow. These guys in the NBA, some of them, somebody like Drummond, for example, he doesn't know, like, what city he's going to be living in tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like, we take so much of that for granted. Now, yes, they get paid all this money, and they get to live a life and have all these experiences, yes. But it is an oddity about being an athlete. It's like, okay, I'm going to be working in Phoenix tomorrow. Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Well, it's jarring when you have kids and, you know, a wife or partner. Like, you leave, and all of a sudden they're like, okay, hang on, we got to get the kids out of school. Like, so you could be away from your family for a while or without a home for a while.
Well, real quick before we go to break, but for me... Jackson, my oldest, he was going to be born in June, and I had originally signed with the Edmonton Eskimos, and I was going to go play in the CFL, and their season starts, and I had to report at the end of May. So I didn't know if I was going to, you know, have the opportunity to go to, you know, my child being born, right, and be there with Brooke and all that. And then while I was on vacation out there, and the draft was happening, the Seahawks called me and were like, hey, we want to draft you. So in a matter of, or we want to sign you. So in a matter of like 24 hours, our whole mindset and our differences in terms of our plans a month later were immediately turned on its head. It worked out for the better, obviously. It was a tremendous blessing. But just thinking about that, it can change in one phone call. It's crazy.
Were you ready to live up there in Calgary?
Yeah.
What'd you say, Edmonton?
The Edmonton Eskimos.
The True North, strong and free.
That's right.
I feel like
that's
you'd right. be a good Canadian, Jake.
You think so?
Yeah,
maybe.
I did too.
Yeah, get a Canadian vibe from you sometimes.
Sorry.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Just be very polite.
Very polite. Yeah.
Just affable.
Yeah, I would feel good about living there for half the year. Yeah, I don't think I could do it all year round.
Tough winter up in Edmonton.
Tough winter.
Woo!
Did you guys hear about this hoax coming out of Ole Miss? This National Signing Day hoax is a really funny story. We have to talk about this next. Tom, Jake, and Stacey, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios,
streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
This is a very confusing story. And it's confusing because most of us haven't been in the position where we've been a part of National Signing Day, where we're, you know, about to put our names down on the dotted line. But this one kid, Detravion Brown, who went to Northwood High School down in Mississippi, he claims to be signing for Ole Miss. He says, I'd like to thank God for everything he did for me. I wouldn't be here in this position. When asked about what it was that Ole Miss made them, or what it was that Ole Miss liked about him, he said, oh, the coaching staff, they loved me when I got out here. And, you know, I just fell in love with the town and everything. And then it turns out that Ole Miss confirmed that no scholarship has been offered to him at all. And the school, not only that, the school has no paperwork on him whatsoever. So he just showed up and purported to be a signee for Ole Miss.
This is an interesting story because this comes down to, you know, coming down to offers being extended by a previous staff, and then Lane Kiffin comes in, and their staff does not honor that original offer that he had received. But the thing was, is before this, before he went out and did this, he knew that he didn't have an offer from Ole Miss anymore, that he was notified. What'd you say, Stacey, the morning of this whole situation?
Very shortly before.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the morning of, but very shortly before.
So he was notified of this and then continued to go through this anyways, and have this signing day saying that he was committed to Ole Miss. Doesn't make any sense.
What did he think he was going to accomplish?
I'm not exactly sure.
Maybe it's a pride thing. Maybe it was something where, you know, he's embarrassed, right? That here he thought he was committing to Ole Miss, having this big press conference about it, signing day, special moment, and he gets his offer pulled. I don't know.
Well, he
but
came
that's,
out.
That's a very strange thing.
His mom issued a kind of an apology on Facebook, and she said, she wanted to apologize to everyone that showed support and said it was a lack of communication. So maybe they felt like, okay, do we just go forward with it? I mean, do we wait to hear a final? It was either where he was trolling Ole Miss and saying, like, sucks for you guys. Like, I'm just going to continue to do this because that was messed up of you to pull that offer, and I'm just going to pull a hoax on you. Or it was that he genuinely, there was a lack of communication, and he wasn't sure what the deal was and was like, well, this was supposed to be my signing day, so.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's like when Pete Rose goes up to Cooperstown because he's not allowed in the Hall of Fame, and he just sits right next to the museum signing autographs,
yeah.
in front of the restaurant or whatever. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, that's probably a good aspect of that, but that's where I've talked about this before, is recruiting has changed so much. And yeah, there's a transition there. That's why Nick Rolovich from Washington State, as he was going around the state visiting recruits, just reaffirming any kid that had an offer from Washington State, he wanted to make very clear that they were re-offering them, that it was their staff that was giving this offer to them, so that there was no miscommunication on any end. So you avoid situations like this. But two, there are so many kids, like, I look around and I tell so many, you know, athletes and parents that, you know, juniors and sophomores and freshmen that receive offers at this time of the year, the reality is by the time your senior year rolls around, that is probably a non-committable offer. That there are so many offers that are being thrown out these days by college recruiters,
yeah,
that it doesn't mean anything. It literally means nothing. And that's the hard part, is deciphering what's real, which school genuinely has interest in you, or that they're just casting out this wide net now as in terms of offering these days. It's just very, very different.
Well, and I think it's really cruel because these are not – I mean, all of us are adults and we read about it and we think like, oh, well, I mean, whatever. But these are children. They're 18 years old. Sometimes maybe they're 17 years old. And like this one story. So again, who knows what the intent was behind what he did, but the principal of his high school did an interview and she said he texted us saying, is all of this my fault? Like with them kind of taking back their offer. So I think that is not a unique feeling. And Jake's talked to a lot of recruits. I'm sure that's not a unique feeling kids have when this stuff is revoked, or when it ends up being only a verbal offer and not an official offer. I'm sure that there's a feeling of, did I do something wrong? Because I'm 18 years old and I'm wondering what I did wrong.
And I can imagine this process is probably not the most simple process in the world either.
No, not at all. I mean, yeah.
Confusion, yeah. Miscommunication, etc.
Absolutely.
Let's go to our next story here. Damian Williams wants his Super Bowl jersey back after swapping with Raheem Mostert. I'm telling you, man,
what?
Jersey swapping, shouldn't be doing it.
Especially not your Super Bowl jersey. When you're getting to the point where you're getting into the playoffs and you got the divisional round, and you've got
the
AFC NFC championship, then the Super Bowl, you're going to swap your Super Bowl jersey that you just won in. Are you kidding me?
I think that this was originally a show of support for Raheem Mostert because they both play together in Miami?
In Miami, correct.
In Miami.
Most undrafted.
Exactly. And it was actually very touching. Again, that mic'd up episode is awesome, but it's also floating around Twitter and Facebook, so you can find it if you want to. But he goes up and he says, hey, this isn't the end of your journey. It's not the end of our journey. I believe in you. Like, you deserve to be here. You're going to be back. Keep your head up kind of thing. Really encouraging.
And
like
that,
the first thing he did after the game. And then he went on Jimmy Kimmel.
That's the clip. This starts with Jimmy Kimmel asking him about that clip that Stacey's referencing.
Now, there you are after the game. Who are you talking to there?
Raheem, man. That's my dude right there.
You're talking to Raheem from the Niners, and you guys exchange jerseys. Is that a tradition?
You know, when they started doing this, you know, a couple years ago, I really wasn't a fan, or I really didn't do that much because, you know, I didn't want to, especially after a win or a loss, go up to somebody like, hey, let me get your jersey.
Uh-huh. Right.
you know, we built the friendship, you know, when he came to Miami with us, you know, he was only there for, you know, a short time. And I talked to him before the game, like, you know, I don't care what happens, you know, I want to speak to you, you know, after the game. And I made sure I did that.
That's nice. That's really nice. Now, I will tell you, though, that you realize because you guys won and they didn't, and the jersey you gave him is worth a lot more than the jersey he gave you.
And that's funny you say that because my mom was like, where's your jersey at?
Oh, no.
I'm like, man. I say, yeah, I gave it away.
I'll call him. I'll get it back.
So then Raheem made a separate joke on Twitter, and I don't know if he offered it or if Damian reached out, but Raheem tweeted out a picture of Damian's jersey and said, you know, I was going to sell it on eBay, but this is yours, and you deserve to have it back.
Okay, so good, because he's
got to give it back.
He's got to give that back. That's good that he.
Yeah,
that's good.
He said, contemplated putting this on eBay with a laughing emoji.
Yeah.
But this belongs to you and yours. You did your thing. Hand this down to generations to come. I'm proud of you.
That's the right thing to do. By the way, if you are going to sell it, you should wait.
What if he was like, nah, bro, you gave it up. I'm not letting this thing go.
Hey, man, finders keepers.
Yeah.
I guess you can kiss that friendship goodbye.
That would be crazy.
You got to wait to sell that, though, if your intention is to make money off one of those jerseys, even if you're the rightful owner. Like, years down the line, it's going to be, hey, game-used Chiefs jersey from Damian Williams, the would-be MVP.
From Terrell Davis's Broncos jersey.
Exactly.
Nowadays, like, whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah, that'd be worth quite a bit of coin. All right, we're going to talk to Lydia Cruz, who is our 710 ESPN Seattle Dragons insider. We've got the XFL coming up this week, so we're going to talk to Lydia, bring her in here. That's next on 710 ESPN Seattle.